I felt a need to create my own stories, the stories in my songs, and that was what was driving me and still drives me today, is just to tell these stories. But you've got to tell them to somebody. So that becomes part of it. You've got to sing to people. You've got to find an audience that's going to keep it going. So the sharing with other people is sort of part of the process. But I think even if there's no audience, I would still be wanting to write these stories.
Hi, I'm Mike Abel. I'm a business, marketing, and communications specialist and the founder of MNC Saatchi Abel. I'm a family man, a problem solver, a futurist, and an optimist at heart. Welcome to my podcast, Willing and Able, the home of hopeful conversations that challenge perspectives. It's a continuation of the ideas and conversations I began in my book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis. My guest today is cultural icon David Kramer, one of South Africa's most recognized and beloved artists, a singer, songwriter, playwright, director, and with a career spanning 50 years. I'm thrilled to have you here today, David. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's really nice that you've invited me, and I'm also thrilled to be here.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to you and I having a lekker conversation. I found when I see you, Afrikaans comes very easily to me.
Great. Yeah, tweetalige boekie van.
Yeah, I guess.
Funny bye.
Yeah, ek praat 'n bietjie. David, you know, I always like to start a conversation with somebody like yourself going back to, I guess, childhood. And I know that you come from Worcester.
Yes.
So I think let's start there and talk a little bit about your childhood growing up in Worcester. And what was it particularly, I guess, that awakened this creativity in you? Because you've had this and have this amazing creative career and journey. Tell us a little bit about when you kind of started to lean into music and creativity.
Yes, I think the first thing to mention is that I was very lucky that in Worcester we had an art school. It was the Joganodi Art School. And during my high school years, I studied art there. And the art teachers that I met had an influence on me, as well as a music teacher that I had in primary school, whose name was Cromwell Everson. And he was quite an eccentric sort of guy. He had a beard, and I think he hated teaching, you know. But we've discovered that both of us were very keen on poetry. I was much more interested in poetry as a youngster than I was in learning to play the piano.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was about 11, so that was 1962, 63, when the Beatles came on the radio, and that had a huge influence on me, and I decided I'd wanted to learn to play the guitar. And the other thing, we had what they called bioscopes in those years. There were two bioscopes in Worcester. One was the 20th Century Fox, and the other was the Scala Bioscope, and where I spent a lot of time watching films. And I saw some interesting things there that I suppose affected me. I mean, like I saw West Side Story, the film at that time.
Yes.
And I remember seeing a concert of Elvis performing and maybe some Beatle footage and stuff like that. So that all fired my enthusiasm and imagination for being a performer, I suppose. I wanted to perform. I mean, I had been performing as a kid in my parents' lounge since I was about 6 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That performance desire was there from very young. I just had to find a way of getting some sort of way of doing it, and the guitar was the first step.
So you started learning the guitar at, did you say 11?
Yes, 11.
Amazing. Okay. I think that what people don't realize, and I think it's probably a good way to touch on that, is, you know, you mentioned the 20th century and you mentioned the Scala. It's quite interesting because David knew my late grandfather, Julius Abel, who owned those two bioscopes. And I never met Julius because he died 2 years before I was born. But I believe that you used to perform in the
cinema. No, I didn't perform there, but they did have bands performing like on the stage of the 20th century. We called it the 20th century. So like at interval, they had a band called Budgie and the Swinging Jets. And I wrote a song about them.
I know that song.
Many years ago. But there is a bit of a myth that I also played on those stages. But I was in another band in Worcester, the sort of rival band to the Swinging Jets.
Yes.
That band was called the Offbeats. But your grandfather, I was telling you, you know, he was a formidable kind of presence because he was quite a big man. And he was in the ticket office. And I was a youngster, you know, and looking up through this glass window and buying my cinema ticket from him. And then I was also telling you about Mike Johnson, who worked for your grandfather. And Mike Johnson was quite a character who drove around Worcester on a Vespa scooter. And in those years, there was a tax on cinema tickets. And Mike Johnson's job was supposedly to tear the tickets when you went in to see the film.
Yes.
But we all noticed that Mike Johnson wasn't tearing the tickets. He was sort of folding them into his hand and showing us in. Seemed a bit strange. But then we realized they weren't tearing the tickets because there was a tax on the tickets. And he could actually give them back to Mr. Abel. Then they could be resold. And so you avoided some of the tax.
That's a great story. I hope they don't come after his grandson all these years later.
I'll tell them it's just one of David Cromer's stories. He made it up.
Okay. Oh, there's a funny story that you say that there's this myth of you performing at the 20th century when they were changing the reels, because I actually heard that story from my own late dad, Bernie.
Yes.
So I can't correct him. No.
Yeah. No, this happens. I mean, you know, on Facebook, in fact, somebody wrote not long ago and said, oh, I remember you performing at the 20th Century Fox. And I was right back and said, well, I don't remember me performing there, but fine.
Or maybe it's because of Budgie and the Jets that
is what happens. Yeah. I mean, people do remember that I played and that there was other bands that played it, you know, and that somehow because I wrote Budgie and the Jets, it all gets to become one new story. I mean, I think that happens a lot. Yeah. We're not aware of it, how we recreate our own mythology.
Yeah.
We definitely do that.
That's right.
Forget what we want to conveniently and
embellish
embellish the other stuff. And yeah, you know, our stories are our own. As my brother would always say, I don't remember it like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. We have the permission to create a better version of reality.
Well, you know, like in our family, I mean, I would tell stories and, you know, always exaggerate the comedic aspect of it or, you know, whatever. And then my brother's, but it wasn't like that, you know. I know, but, you know, it's funnier the way I tell it.
Exactly. Creative license, as we say. And David, I mean, being such an iconic South African, which you are, and I mean, we're going to talk a little bit more about your activism and I guess the profoundly important role that you've played in this country in terms of making people aware of uncomfortable conversations at a time that it wasn't actually even allowed to have an uncomfortable conversation. But when people hear your name, what do you think they picture?
Oh, I think they very much picture the Volkswagen ad. The Volkswagen ads really embedded my image into the minds of the nation generally.
Yeah.
And that is this guy with a middle parting in his greased, broad-creamed hair, riding a bicycle with red shoes. So the immediate image would be the guy on the bicycle with the red shoes. In later years, the pork pie hat, I mean, people would recognize me now for the pork pie hat. But I think that's the image that they think of, a funny guy on a bicycle.
Okay. Oh, you've just spoken about the Foxy ad, so we might as well go straight there.
Okay.
Why not? And then we'll come back to some other questions. But, well, I mean, I guess another intersection of our lives together is that you and I did work a bit together back in the days of Radford, Saltrip and Macon. Certainly I joined the journey on the Foxy bus ads later than you did. But why don't you tell our guests today about how that came about in terms of you being associated with Volkswagen and Foxy Bus in particular, because you've added so much folklore to those stories. And I think that unlike most automotive advertising, you know, the Foxy Bus stories became part of the fabric of South Africa in terms of storytelling.
Yes, I mean, unusual. I don't have TV anymore, so I don't know what the ads look like. But I don't think they make ads like that anymore.
Not at all.
You know, which are so story-based. I mean, these ads were almost 1 minute long. And a beautiful little story was told in that 1 minute, which featured the Foxy Bus as the hero and me as the kind of comic sidekick. So it came about because before I even went into being a professional entertainer, I was working in the textile industry. And we employed Radford, Saltrip, Macon, the company that I worked for, as our advertising agency.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And so I met some of the guys there, you know, in those early days. I was working for a company called SA Nylon Spinners. Then they got a year that I played and I was having some concerts. and I invited some of them to come and see me. So this was very early, this is 1981, and they came, I think, to one of my concerts, and they saw what I was doing in terms of the, you know, the audience telling these stories and the audience responding to them, and that I was so sort of different to everybody else. They loved it. But at the time, Nick Taylor,
yes,
was writing the Volkswagen jingle.
Yeah.
And I think it came to a point where they had to renegotiate, and Nick was getting expensive. And they thought, but there's this guy who's kind of also sings like that, you know, sort of Ach, please, Daddy kind of guy. we know, David, let's ask him if he won't write the jingle.
And was the jingle at the time VW and Me, We All Believe Most Definitely?
Now, that was Nick Taylor.
Yes.
Now, I'm talking about, Jeremy Taylor.
Okay.
So before Nick Taylor,
okay.
Jeremy Taylor.
Okay.
You know, Ach, please, Daddy.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got my Taylors mixed up.
Wait, did you take me to the drive-in?
That guy.
Yeah.
So he had written the first Folksy Bus jingles.
Okay.
Or jingle.
Okay.
As I say, it came up for a renegotiation, got expensive, and they thought maybe I should write a new jingle for them.
Yeah.
I didn't. But that's sort of how it started.
Okay.
And then they came to me and said, you know, we've got this idea for an ad, and we'd actually like you to be in the ad.
Yeah.
And we see you as a kind of South African everyman.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't keen at all.
For what reason?
I had no interest in sort of commercializing myself.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be a bad idea.
Yes.
The way I'd sort of positioned myself as a songwriter who had something to say about the social and political situation at that time, I really was quite aware that my audience would feel I was sort of selling out to commercial interests. So anyway, it's always good not to want to do something.
Yeah.
It's better to want to walk away than to embrace it.
I think those are the moments that define us in life, is what we choose not to do rather than what we do.
So they offered more.
Mm, good.
and I still refused. But I wasn't, you know, I just really didn't think. It wasn't because I was trying to get more money or anything. And then I think I met Greg Burke and spoke about it, and I suddenly saw the possibilities of just being myself. I think my fear was that they would want me to endorse the bus.
Yes.
At that point, I was quite well known in South Africa. I'd had big hits like Akon Blokkies and the Royal Hotel, and so on. I mean, I was doing well. I was quite a well-known entertainer figure.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to be seen endorsing the bus. So I made that point. So he said, well, maybe we can find a way of creating these little stories and in which you just play yourself and, you know, the bus is the bus. And I said, well, that sounds more like it to me, because I'm certainly not leaning out of the window of the bus, tapping the side, here buses for yellow. Folksy bus. Yeah, they came up with the first story, and I liked that very much. And then I came on board.
Yeah.
And I said to them, but I want a bus.
Yeah.
It's okay, we'll lend you the bus. I said, no, you won't lend me the bus. You'll give me a bus with every ad I do. And that's what happened as well.
Very nice, very nice. Look, I mean, I think that was an iconic time in advertising in South Africa.
It was, particularly with Reitwitz Ultrup Macon.
Yeah.
I mean, they did that Volkswagen, not only the bus ad, but so many of the other products.
Yeah.
With that sort of James Bond image on one of those cars of these.
Yeah.
I know there were some wonderful ads.
They were breaking the sound barrier with the right stuff, the downhill racer.
Yes.
A big part of my life as well, and a beautiful point of intersection. So, David, your activism, how old were you when you kind of looked around yourself in South Africa and you thought, this isn't right? Because I remember being a young man, I can't remember, what year did District 6 come out?
1987.
Yeah.
It came onto stage.
Yeah. So I was studying in Port Elizabeth, in Qabeja, as it's now known, and I went to go and see it at the Opera House.
Oh, yes.
And I'd been raised, fortunately, I had good parents that made me keenly aware of the inequalities and the horrors of apartheid. And I watched this and I thought, this is an amazing story. When did you first become an activist, and when did you realize that you could use poetry, creativity, music, and performance to get people to sit up and take note? Because The only other thing that I saw on stage that I thought was immensely brave around the same time, I think, was Peter Dirk Ace's Adapt or Die, where he was making fun of South African politicians and Piet Koornhof and those types of people. What was it, David?
Yeah, so, you know, as a teenager growing up in an apartheid town, I was aware of it and I had an uneasy feeling about, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I wasn't, you know, politically astute at that point, I suppose, but I knew that it was a kind of mad what was going on. And then I had the good fortune of going to Leeds University in England to study textiles. And then I really, you know, my eyes were really opened. Mm. It was a very politically active left-wing university. Mm. And I suddenly was exposed to what had been going on in South Africa, you know, beyond our town.
Mm.
So, yeah, so then I started to include that in my songwriting at that time. And so I was in my very early 20s. But again, you know, I don't only write like that. And I'm not known for that kind of writing because I was also writing comedic songs and using comedy overseas to make people laugh at the fact, at the absurdity of being South African. So it was there from my early 20s and started to be part of my songwriting. And when I first became known in South Africa on my return from university, I was singing songs about sort of social, describing the social life of South Africa in either a comedic or a political way. And I gained an audience of university students. So I was performing at like UCT and Stellenbosch University in Durban and folk clubs. So I had a following of very sort of liberal English-speaking or liberal students.
Mm.
But all of my work then was in English.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I started to move over to Afrikaans. Oh, you know, look, in the late 70s, I became very interested in connecting to a folk tradition, so that kept asking myself that question. I didn't want to connect to like an outside tradition. I didn't want to be influenced by, say, American folk music or British folk music. So what can I connect to in South Africa?
Mm.
You know, I don't speak Zulu like Johnny Clegg. Johnny Clegg could do that in his way. So the Afrikaans folk tradition that was born in the Cape in District 6 became something of huge interest to me.
Yeah.
And it stretched back hundreds of years.
Yeah, yeah.
So I loved that and I started to investigate that and bring it into my songs.
Mm.
And that English-speaking sort of liberal audience, they didn't understand what I was doing at all.
Yeah.
And they sort of felt, no, I'm going to the other side, you know.
Yeah,
because I was singing in Afrikaans.
But I think that, and certainly for our overseas listeners, Afrikaans is such an incredibly evocative language. And when you say certain things in Afrikaans, and certainly when you fluk, translated as swear in Afrikaans, there are very few things that capture the exact thing. And so, you know, even today when I do like talks with my people in the agency or clients or whatever, I'll often cross over to an Afrikaans word because it will capture the essence of that thing.
Yeah, or idioms. There's some very, you know, very vivid idioms.
Yes. Do you want to share some?
We won't even mention them now.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah.
But yes,
it's very interesting, you know, because, and again, the politics around the language is that we grew up under the nationalist government, and since the 1930s, the nationalists had been really manipulating culture.
Yeah.
To a large, very much rewrite.
Kultur.
Yeah, ons eier.
Yeah.
Het woord aan ons en dus ons eier. But they didn't really have anything. What they did was they appropriated old Afrikaans folk songs that became part of the Boere Musiek crowd in the 1934, I think it was the centenary in the, you know, of the Great Trek, the Groot Trek, and there were all these festivals. And and so they played this music like Seikabosi and, you know, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it became thought of as white Afrikaans music.
Mm.
But it wasn't.
Mm.
And so the myth carried on, this idea of ons eier, and as if Afrikaans was a white man's language.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't.
Yes.
It came out of the mouths of slaves. And to this day, people don't really want to accept that idea. They imagine that somehow Afrikaans was invented by the farmers here and the laborers who worked for them learnt Afrikaans from them.
Yeah.
It was the other way around.
Yes, yes. Isn't it a form of Dutch in terms of wasn't it referred as like kombuis Afrikaans or kitchen Dutch,
yeah.
if you like.
So yeah, it was a Creole language. It's creolization.
Oh, that's interesting.
And creolization happens where you find slaves.
Yeah.
It happened in the Caribbean. So wherever you have that kind of power discrepancy and you bring people from different countries in the Indian Ocean Basin.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they come from India, Malaysia, and Madagascar, and all these. You bring yeah. these people with, and they have no way of communicating.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have to start to use the master's language, and it gets creolized.
Yeah, yeah.
And becomes a new form of, you know, certainly most of it is from Dutch, but it isn't anything like Dutch anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that because until this moment, and I am 57 years old, I've never actually considered that. And you've taken me in my mind straight to the cotton fields in America and slavery there.
Yes.
And the beautiful music, the painful music, the poetic music that also came out of the slaves there that has played such an enormous role.
Yeah. So that's what happens. I mean, you know, people
amazing,
are thrown together in unusual circumstances.
Yeah. yeah.
And, I mean, it happens with music, it happens with food. So you look at the Cape. Yeah, in the Cape, you know, we have traditional Cape cooking. It's a kind of creolization of food. The architecture, it was all Malaysian slave labor that built the Cape Dutch homesteads. So various aspects of what we consider to be traditionally Cape now
yeah.
came out of that bumping up of cultures
yeah.
and people. You
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
You have to think of Cape Town as a Creole city. Its origins are Creole.
That's amazing.
A lot of things we've got wrong about Cape yeah. Town, and we don't even promote them or understand. I did a musical with Tully Peterson called Guma. Now, Guma is the music that comes out of the Cape.
Yeah.
And I don't think before that musical, other than people within the kind of community that Tully came from, was really aware of the rhythm of Guma and what Guma meant and so on. Yeah, certainly outside of Cape Town, it wasn't very well known. But Guma is a rhythm, largely, and played on what's called the Guma drum. And that drum today, if you were at the carnival recently, they walk through the streets with a drum, which is made from segments of plywood. So it looks like a wine barrel.
Okay.
And it's got a skin over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an original Cape Town instrument.
Is that like a Khoisan origin? I mean,
again, creolization.
Yeah.
It's the only drum in Africa that's not made from a tree.
Okay.
So how did it come into being? The ships, in time of when the ships came, everything was in wooden vats.
Yeah.
Or on the farms, all the wine was stored in vats.
Yeah.
So if you worked as a slave on the farm,
yeah.
got hold of a small wine vat, and you knocked out the bottom. You knocked out the bottom and the top, and you turned it into a drum, which is called a guma.
Okay.
And that's a Cape invention, and the only one in Africa.
Yeah.
So we should be, instead of having statues of silly old politicians or Jan van Riebeek, we should have a big statue of a guma drum down in the foreshore.
I love it. I love it. Let's do that, David. There's a big story for you to tell in your next play about Creole and Cape Town and our history.
Well, guma is about that. Guma was a musical about the origins of Afrikaans. That's what we did in guma.
Okay. And if we want to see guma now, what is it online? Is there anywhere we can go to?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, we made a DVD of it at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, so I do have it, but and people ask for these things online, but I've been cautious with the internet.
Yeah.
Because we as creative artists, I mean, Spotify and those kind of, you know, they've stolen everything from us. It's a miserable situation.
Oh, wow.
Where once upon a time you could make a living from writing and recording songs, you can no longer do so.
Well, maybe we need to digitize it and put it on YouTube and find a way of you.
Well,
you know,
YouTube is still better. YouTube is better. I mean,
you
know, I've got my stuff on YouTube, and you can certainly go to my channel, David Cramer, on YouTube.
Yeah.
And there you will find many, many, many videos of me performing in the 80s,
yeah.
as well as these extracts from Guma and District 6, the yeah. musical, and Cat and the Kings. And so, yeah, so there's many clips,
yeah.
but not the full-length
yeah.
versions of these shows yet, as yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that that has to be a project because yeah. I think it's such important history that...
it would be nice to make yeah. it available. And I suppose I'm getting to an age now where it doesn't matter so much, you know. And okay, all right, let's put it out.
Nonsense. You're young. The smartest man in the world in finance and investing is substantially older than you. He could be your father, being Warren Buffett at 98. We still expect a lot from you, David. None of that talk, thank you.
Mike Abel's book, Willing and Able, Lessons from a Decade in Crisis, captures the stories of clients and partners and the wins, losses, and learnings through his eyes in a career spanning 3 decades. Whether you're looking for courage or inspiration to learn what it takes to disrupt industries or discover how to transform your company meaningfully and truly empower your people, you'll find it between these pages. You can listen to the audiobook on Audible, download it on your Kindle, order it online, or find it at your favorite bookstore.
I mean, you've spoken a lot about culture, and you know, I think that you've been very clever at the way that you've weaved culture in South Africa. You know, we spoke earlier as one of our memories of Sunny van der Spey and her Milk Tart,
mm-hmm.
and that is culture right there. You know, it brings to life these characters that one ordinarily wouldn't maybe know about or be interested in. So you give them relevance. What does culture mean to you?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, that culture. I'm not quite sure, because culture isn't a thing, you know. It's an interface, I think. I think culture is an interface in the way... So language is part of culture. And it's something that, you know, when you speak, say you speak English or Afrikaans or French or whatever, you know, it's so much part of you that you can use that as an interface without thinking. I think that, then that's culture. But I think... A lot of the time, people get confused with cultural objects and culture.
Mm.
And you know, people would like to say, oh, it's my culture. It's, you know, this is my culture. But it's not.
Yeah.
It's nonsense, because people like to draw boundaries around things and say, this is what it is and belongs to me. But when you look into that, there's so much variety within this concept of culture. Maybe you think you've got like a Boerkaap culture, and my culture is kusistas and singing in the Malay choirs and all this. Mm. But that's a part of it. But at the same time, you also are making TikTok videos and you're very interested in making music on computers and you have a love of the blues. And you know, so where yeah. does your culture begin and end?
Yeah,
I was always interested, right from an early age, to explore the grey areas, because that's what the government told us then, that, you know, we should be separated because we have separate cultural identities. So I think I kind of get a little bit prickly when we get into this area of your culture.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a nonsense.
Yeah.
And what I was more interested in was that people share so much.
Yeah.
You know, and we should be looking in South Africa not at separate identities and being separated by this mythology of it Orns is Orns and yellow is yellow. We shouldn't be separated like that. We should rather look towards our humanity and understand that when you really start to take it down to the individual, each one's different.
Yeah. It's incredibly powerful what you say, because there's such a focus today, in a good way and in a very bad way, actually, on identity. And I think culture plays completely into that. And I'm not sure where your forefathers come from, but, you know, with myself, 2-3 generations back, being 100% from Eastern Europe, Lithuania, and then tracing my roots further back to actually Spanish Inquisition, Spain and Portugal, which is where my great-grandmother's family comes from. And you talk about culture today, and I think that while you're talking, and I'm thinking, like, how much of my culture is defined by having chicken soup and knedlach on Rosh Hashanah, or eating a cook sister, or having a braai, or a samosa, or umngushu.
Yeah, and you do all those things, don't you?
All those things, and we actually casseroles in South Africa. You know, we're a bit of peas and a bit of carrots. And
I was going to say, you know, you asked, like, I'm a brak, you know. I come from all different strands. So not just from one particular area, if you go backwards, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a pavement special, I suppose.
Yeah.
In terms of
They call a brakkie an Afrikaners today. You can't say my dog is a brak when you go to the vet, because I've had brakkies, and they say, oh, it's an Afrikaners.
I've not heard that one.
Haven't you heard that?
No, I haven't heard that. And why would that be?
Okay. I don't know. I think all right, So a lot of your later work, and I think you've touched on this, but I'd love to dig a little bit deeper, involves showcasing roots music of the Cape, as well as the talents of other artists. Mm. Talk a little bit about that, because that fascinates me in terms of an artist showcasing other talents.
Yeah. Are you referring to the Karugatal Blues Project?
I am.
Yeah. So again, you know, this interest in roots music and the roots of where I come from, yeah, in the Western Cape and the Karoo, I'm fascinated by that, and I love to scratch around and delve into history and where did it come from and who'd, you know, there's very little information. It was the year 2000. I get a call from a documentary filmmaker called Jan Horn, and he says he's making a program of sort of different various kinds of South African music, and he wants to do one on the Kariki Mensa of the Karoo.
Okay.
Those are sort of sheep shearers who travel around on donkey carts in the Karoo from farm to farm. And they have a way of singing and Afrikaans songs. Mm. And I said, well, that sounds fascinating. And I joined up with him.
Mm.
And we went traveling around looking for people who might sing this old Afrikaans music from the Karoo.
Mm.
I didn't think it existed anymore.
Mm.
I thought it had died out because I heard it as a child.
Mm.
My father had a furniture shop in the same street that your grandfather had, the 20th Century Fox, and it was called Western Furniture. And I used to spend a lot of time in this furniture shop, and next to the furniture shop was a bottle store.
Yeah.
So on a Saturday morning, the farmers would bring the laborers in.
Yeah.
And they would do their shopping.
Yeah.
They would come into the store and they would play on the guitars, maybe buy one on lay-by. And
wow.
They would wait at the bottle store for the lorry to come and fetch them again, and, you know, a few drinks and a lot of singing and dancing and playing, which I remember as a child, Afrikaans songs. And that I thought had gone. But with Jan, we found people who were absolutely amazing and luckily remembered. I mean, I could kind of call it the last wave. The generation before them would have been very, very exciting, I think.
Mm.
Anyway, so I met some of these people that I thought were outstanding, and I wanted to share the experience with the city audience because I knew people had never heard any of this sort of stuff. It was actually my wife, Renee, who said, why don't you just bring some of them along to the festival in Oudtshoorn and, you know, we'll let them perform alongside you and we'll see what happens.
Mm.
And I did just that in 2001, maybe. The emotional impact on the audience was incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, people just basically burst into tears when they heard these people singing and playing the guitar. You know, there was Hannes Kutsier, who became an international phenomenon with his teaspoon slide guitar playing.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So anyway, and I thought, well, I could use my fame.
Yeah.
To showcase other people who would never get outside of their towns, you know. They weren't even performing. That wasn't a concept.
Yeah.
It was just sort of they as a family, or they made music when there was a party.
Yeah.
But the idea of, you know, I'm going to become a performer and play for other people wasn't part of the thinking.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what was going to happen. When I put them in front of 700 people and lights and monitors and microphones. And, you know, I thought, oh, my God, what if they just freeze up? You know, this is...
Sure.
And it was nothing like that. It didn't seem to bother them in the least, you know. They just walked on stage. and did what they did as they would at home. And the audience was transfixed. And then I also realized that when I thought about that, is that like some of these, I mean, most of them were so used to not being seen, being invisible, and sit in front of a huge audience, it didn't bother them. The kind of in that invisible cloak that they wore was there.
Yeah, and I think that also, if you don't have, I guess, an ego, and you're just comfortable in your own skin and being yourself and doing what comes naturally to you, you're not kind of, don't have stage fright because you're not thinking what they're thinking of me, what they're thinking, you're just being yourself, doing something that you
It was very pure.
Yeah.
It was pure because that's what they were doing, Mark. They were just making the music that they make.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of me wanting them to play certain songs
was
quite foreign. You know, why would you want me to play that? But
you
played it last night.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I had a program.
Yes, sure.
You know, I sang a song and then I brought Hannes on and then, you know, I wanted him to do three songs. And, you know, there was a program and I knew which songs worked. But they didn't want to really do it like that. They just wanted to pick up the guitar and tune it for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then play whatever they felt like playing.
Yeah.
They had... I would say, what is the name of that song?
Yeah.
No, he doesn't really know. He doesn't know what the name of the song is. It's just something he plays, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so it was very pure. I mean, it's the sort of thing where they talk about all this stuff all the time, being in the moment, you know, and really living like an actor. You know, if you're an actor, you have to live the reality of, you know, the imagined moment.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So but they were that almost all the time.
Well, it's amazing, David, because while I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, how blessed and fortunate and brave you are to be pursuing a creative life. And a lot of the people that will be listening today, we live in a world now where there are people called influencers and they share their opinion and lots of talent and people grow up with reality TV and we've all seen X Factor and we've seen, you know, people, unlikely people that have got a great voice that are discovered kind of late in life. I'm reminded Boyle, I can't remember her first name, that came out as that lady in England, Susan Boyle.
Mm.
And she sang, I think, one of the songs from, I think, an Andrew Lloyd Webber show or something. But
that's right, yeah. And she was on one of those like competitions. Yeah.
Correct.
Mm.
But all of a sudden, she kind of had this global platform to show how incredibly talented and brilliant. And there'll be a lot of people listening, and I'm going to ask you a very specific question about that because myself, having grown up in advertising, I've chosen a commercial career, but a creative career because I'm in the industry purely for creativity, for no other reason. The fact that it's been commercial is a byproduct. It's simply because I'm deeply in love with ideas, you know. But I had the benefit also of when I went off to varsity, I went to study architecture because I thought that was a responsible profession, you know, until it kind of, I got this big fat book on the fundamentals of plumbing and that sent me running out the lecture hall and never back again. But I grew up with an uncle who you knew, who was an actor, a man called Percy Seef.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Very much an influence on me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes. A quick story. So in Worcester, where I grew up, there was a little theatre. It was called the Little Theatre and it had 200 seats. And occasionally people would stop by and perform there. Like Charles Jacoby came along and he performed there. And I remember, you know, so these were the only times I actually saw people on the stage performing.
Yeah.
And Johnny Congas and the G-Men,
yeah,
who went off to London and became quite famous,
yeah,
they played there one night. And Des and Dawn played there one night. And I went to see Percy Seef and he did two halves. The first half was Herman Charles Bosman stories. And the second one was Oomskalk Lawrence.
Mm.
And for the first time, I understood that the South African accent, which was like so much like mine, was legitimate. That hadn't occurred to me before.
Yes.
That I could use my own voice to tell stories.
Yes.
And not pretend to be somebody else. And that Percy gave to me through his performances. And I got to know him very well afterwards. In fact, his good friend, Haim Rabinowitz,
I knew Haim well.
Yeah, Nick.
The potter.
Haim the potter, whose son is Nick Rabinowitz.
The comedian.
The comedian, who I also know quite well. Yeah. But when Percy thought I appreciated a lot of what he did, and so he left me a very old concertina.
Okay.
Which I've now given to Nick.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
And you know Nick is his godson. So.
That's right. No, no, absolutely.
Amazing.
So Percy, all those things, you know, and Percy and Hyman, they were involved with the rock art of, you know, the what's called Bushman paintings.
Where Bushman's Kloof is.
Yeah. All these things, all over the place. I mean, they went exploring and found paintings that, you know, they were the first to, with Townley Johnson, to go looking for these rock paintings.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
I remember those early days where they would trek into the bush and
Did you want to say about him? I'm sorry.
Yeah, No, not at all. So what I wanted to say is, for those listening, in terms of having the bravery to choose a creative life, creative industry.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you know, you went off to Leeds to do your postgrad degree in textiles. Funny enough, my father-in-law, Benji Lapiner, went off to do his chemical engineering postgrad in Leeds. You're probably there at the same time. And he's been a fanatical Leeds United supporter ever since. I hope you
are. I have no interest in
soccer.
Any games. I don't like balls being thrown at me. You know, as a youngster and in school, and I had to play cricket, and I got there and they threw this ball at me. You know, it was like a red hard rock. And I thought, are you mad? What do you want to do this for? You know. Then I played a little bit of soccer, and someone crashed into me and broke my collarbone. And I said, that's it. I've had it with balls.
Okay, well, you know, maybe if you'd pursued a career in sport, we wouldn't be sitting here today, David.
No, we wouldn't.
So we're grateful for your fear of balls.
The Street Store turns 10 this year. The world's first rent-free, premises-free, free pop-up store provides a dignified shopping experience to those in need, allowing them to choose from a selection of pre-loved clothing and shoes. Over 1,000 stores have been hosted around the world in the past decade. And now we're calling on you to host your own. Visit thestreetstore.org to sign up and find out how.
So jumping back to the original question, I'm loving all of these segues while we get to it. But talk to people out there that might be thinking about having a creative career, choosing a creative path, which I think is a beautiful way to spend your life, you know, be it an actor, be it an artist, be it a performer, a poet, a singer. We got this world famous opera singer now, Pretty Yendi, you know, who sang at the King's coronation last year, whenever it was. What gave you the bravery, I guess, to leave a career like textiles, which was predictable and would have paid you a good monthly salary, to become a performing artist?
Yeah. So at that time, the idea was get a job, and that's the reason why I ended up in textiles.
Find a girl, settle down.
Yeah, you know, my parents wanted me
to get
a degree and get a job, and then for the next 40, 50 years, that's what you're going to do. And it was the template at that time, I suppose. And my guitar, I thought of as a hobby, and my songwriting and so on. And again, there was very little example of, in my field, that you could take something like songwriting and performing and make some kind of money out of it.
Yes.
You know, there were a few examples, but not very exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people played in steakhouses. There were very few people making much of a living from music. So I just thought of it as a hobby. And as I started to play at these clubs and at the university campuses, I developed quite a large following, because my style of writing and singing was so unusual. I had a unique approach, and people really responded to that, to the point where I thought, let's make a record. And I put my hand in my pocket, and I started to record myself. And then I joined up with Paddy Lee Thorpe, who was at that, it's 1980, and he's starting a record label called Mountain Records in Cape Town. And anyway, we came to an arrangement, and he released my first album, Bakhat, which was immediately banned by the SABC.
Because of Khat?
Because of everything.
Because bakhat is lekker, it's cool, it's nice. What does bakhat
mean? Yes. Everyone says bakhat now. I mean, you have bakhat builders and, you know, everything's got a bakhat label on. But in those days, you couldn't say the word because it was a vulgar word, you know.
Okay.
Even though it didn't really mean anything other than that it's great, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
This is something that's really top of the range. It's bakhat. But it was considered vulgar. And so you couldn't say that on the radio.
Yeah.
You couldn't use that word on the radio. Mm. You know, now you can say whatever you like. So we've made a lot of progress.
Yeah.
So I released that album and was banned, but it sold really, really well. In fact, it went to gold status and it never got any airplay.
Mm.
So then the record company said, haven't you got something else that we can get onto the radio?
Mm.
And I pulled something out of my drawer and I said, I've got this song I wrote about an old rugby player called Blocky Joubert. And so we recorded that, and that became a number one hit on Springbok Radio, which was a national broadcasting station. And it just stayed at number one for quite a few weeks. And suddenly everybody knew my name and everybody wanted me to come and play for them. But now I'm a textile executive.
Yes.
I have my own car. I have a pension fund. You know, I have all this kind of financial security.
Yeah.
And then this idea of, but come and play. And I couldn't really cope with pressures of both of those things. And my wife, Rena, said, why don't you resign and just do it for a year?
Yeah.
See how it goes. Let's see what happens.
The wise Rena.
Yeah.
And she's given you great advice.
Great advice. So I did that, and I've never been back to textiles. So I took that risk. But it was a calculated risk in the sense that I already had a big response to my songs.
Yeah.
And I thought I would just kind of enjoy it for a while. You know, it would be nice to do.
And maybe because you knew you had something to fall back on if it didn't work as well.
Well, that was always the story, wasn't it?
You know?
Get your degree. It's something to fall back on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if anyone ever does that. You sort of fall forward into something else.
Yeah. Well, I love the story of the Spanish conquistadors to that exact point where legend has it when the first thing that they did when they got to a new place was they burnt the ships. So there was no turning back. And I think that in life one needs to kind of do that. If you're going to commit, commit.
Yes, I suppose so. I went into it and it was the beginning of a wonderful new way of, I don't think of it as a career, but it was a wonderful new way of being an artist. And I was successful at it.
So
many aren't.
Yeah.
Whoever's listening.
Yeah.
You know, so many of my peers also very committed to music and songwriting and wanted to do that and more talented than I was, but didn't make it, you know, or at a level that just they got by. So, yeah, there's a lot of financial difficulty involved in pursuing a kind of creative life. And many artists, painters, certainly we know all the sort of stories of the painters that
never sold a piece in their life.
I didn't get much recognition. My father, as I was telling you, worked at the furniture shop, and one of the owners of that shop was a Mr. Jaffe from Cape Town, and he was an art collector, and he would come out, and then he'd get my father to drive him to Montague, because in Montague, John Vels lived in Montague, and he was a starving artist at that point.
Amazing, huh?
And Mr. Jaffe supported him and his family, because they really were on the bones of their backsides, you know? You know the Veltzes.
Sure, of course.
So my father saw what it was like to be an artist who wasn't doing well.
Yeah.
And my brother is an artist, a painter.
Yes.
It was a big fear for my father and mother that we should become artists.
Yes.
You know, that's the last thing they wanted us to do. I understand that.
Yes.
And not when I was young. It didn't make much sense to me. We knew who we were, but we had to find our way down that difficult road.
Yeah. And were you driven, because a lot of what you hear is people having, I guess, a drive or a determination, not just to fulfill their own talent, passion, interest, but to share something with the world. Because a lot of what you've done is not just beautiful creations from David Cromer, but important, important messages. Did you ever feel the need to communicate directly something important with South Africans?
That's a part of it. I felt a need to create my own stories, the stories in my songs, that was what was driving me and still drives me today, is just to tell these stories. But you've got to tell them to somebody. So that becomes part of it. You've got to sing to people. You've got to find an audience that's going to keep it going. So the sharing with other people is sort of part of the process. But I think even if there's no audience, I would still be wanting to write these stories.
That's beautiful, and probably the most important part when it comes to authenticity is that it comes from the heart and then it
finds. Absolutely. You know, so much of the time people are looking over their shoulder, trying to second guess what's popular, what should I be doing, who should I imitate. I say, oh, that one's had a big success with that kind of style, you know, and I can sing like that and I can do this. And that's really a waste of time. Yeah. And you certainly aren't being an artist to do that. I mean, an artist is not just having talent and being able to do something. An artist is having a vision. I think maybe just to take your last sort of point is to say, I think what I wanted to do was show people like what I saw. I saw the world differently.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, hey, have you seen this? I want you to look at this, you know? And I think that's what art does, kind of shows you the possibilities in the ordinary, shows you the extraordinary within the ordinary. And that is very important to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the originality is key. And I think because there's such a plethora of choices and options, and, you know, you spoke about the different musical platforms earlier today, you know, that when you hear a David Kramer singing, and there aren't any copies of you in South Africa at all. You know, you've remained an original.
I mean, it's I was kind of disappointed nobody wanted to copy me. They did my songs, but I can understand because I'm not cool in that way, you know. But it's, I mean, I was the first, Jeremy Taylor did it, Ach Please Daddy, when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And he did it in a satirical, you know, he was mocking it because, I mean, he's from,
of course,
he was from overseas and the way the South African, so he made a mockery of it.
Yeah.
But still, it was that sound made a huge impression on me. And then this thing with Percy Siff and using your own voice.
Yeah.
And when you talk about bravery, it was brave to stand up and just sing in your own voice.
Yes.
And not put on a fake American accent, which was being done then and is to this very day still being done. People do not really want to go out there and sing like who they really are. See, unless if you're an American, you can sing like an American.
Yes.
But if you're a South African or whatever, you have to sing like an American. And that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
So I took that chance, and that was to my advantage.
Yeah.
You know, it really made me different. It made me unique and very recognizable. So when you do hear one of my songs on the radio, if you ever do, you will know it's me.
Of course.
You know, there's nothing, no one else sounds like that.
Yes.
In the same way, no one else sounds like Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
You know, so that is what it's about. I keep saying to younger people, there's only one.
Yeah.
You know, you can't come and tell me, but I sing just as well as her.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter. You might sing better or whatever, but she is who she is. She's Beyonce and you not.
Yeah, that's true. Who said it best? Oscar Wilde said it best, which is, you might as well be yourself because everybody else is already taken. And I think that sums it up perfectly.
I love the way you can come up with these quotes, Mike. I've always wanted to do that, to be, as Oscar Wilde used to say. That's fantastic.
David, I was very encouraged the other night with the Grammys and how Tracy Chapman came out and sang Fast Car.
Yes.
With that chap.
Combs is his.
Yes, Combs. That's right. That song was written in 1988, literally 2 months after Rihanna was born. It went straight back to number one in iTunes.
I saw that.
And to me, that's amazing because it shows how something from 34 years ago still resonates so deeply with the human condition.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what we are talking about. Songs that somehow eke their way through your pores into your heart, that capture your imagination, that make you feel something. So what are you busy working on today? And am I going to, for an ad, have to go and get Hakon Blokkies on an ad or as a track, or are you busy working on creating?
So I moved into writing musicals. I started in 1986. And the first production was District 6, the musical.
Mm.
And, you know, instinctively, Talib and I chose to write about that and the politics of that.
Mm.
It was driven by our kind of anger at the whole forced removals thing.
Completely, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and District 6 had become a forgotten issue
at
the time. Anyway, so the musical came on stage and it had a phenomenal response.
Globally?
Yeah, it was huge. And yeah. I mean, and something like that had never happened before. It changed the whole face of the audience makeup in Cape Town. You know, suddenly the audience completely changed. I mean, the Baxter still is a very different Baxter to what it was before 1987.
Yeah.
So we were extremely fortunate to have written a musical that was a hit straight off, because you don't really get another chance with a musical. It's an expensive business. So then we went on to write quite a few more.
Yeah.
But always our stories, you know, Cape Town stories.
Yeah.
And we wrote one called Cat and the Kings.
Yeah.
In 95.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah, Cat and the Kings. And that did well locally. But when it went to London, it did even better. There was a much stronger reaction in London, which surprised me. I didn't really think they would get my humor, and the relief of hearing an audience laugh at my first joke in England.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, yeah. And then the producers coming from the West End and, you know, wanting to meet with me and Talib and saying, we've got to take this to the West End, which happened. And then we won the Laurence Olivier Award for the best new musical in 1999. The performers won the Laurence Olivier Awards. We went to Broadway, and then the show toured Europe and other places the 10 years after 95. I mean, we only really stopped working on it in 2005. And unfortunately, the last one that Talib and I did was Guma. We went to London with that, and we opened it. And on his return, he came back home from the opening, and he was murdered in his home.
Tragic, I remember.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I lost Talib as a writing partner. But I've continued to write musicals, and I've written quite a few since then.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I have two musicals in the pipeline.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I later in July this year, I will be doing a musical that I presented at the festivals last year called Fair and Iveral Kitty.
Okay.
Which is about cultural appropriation.
Yeah. Kendi Liki.
Yeah.
Which means I know the song.
Yeah. That's an interesting story. Also based on truth.
Yeah.
And then I take true stories and then I turn them into an entertainment. And then the second one is the Cape Town Opera Company is going to do a production of Orpheus McAdoo, which I wrote 10 years ago as Orpheus in Africa. And that was performed at the Fugard Theatre. But it subsequently has undergone a rewriting process, and I've come up with a libretto that I really like. They're going to present that in October this year. So that's what's coming up.
Incredible. Incredible. I'm delighted to hear that you are as creative and prolific as ever. So
yes, absolutely. My brain's working all the time. My body maybe struggles to keep up. And I have another musical behind the two that are coming up that I still want to write. So, yeah, it keeps me very happy, Mike, to be a creative person. And I think everybody is. They just don't have that opportunity to. I think that's what makes, I think a lot of what makes people sad and despondent and depressed is not being able to express their creativity.
Yeah. Well, my late grandfather, I don't know if you ever met him at Percy and Sylvia's house, but he used to have this saying or poem, which is, a man is not old when his hair turns grey, nor is he old when his teeth decay, but is well on his way to his long last sleep when his mind makes appointments that his body can't keep. So you keep on making those appointments, David.
Thank you.
So other than music, and this is our last question because we've run out of time and I could literally spend days here talking to you, what are you curious about at the moment? What's fascinating you in the world right now?
The world is changing rapidly. I think we're all aware of it, of what the internet has done. I mean, I was there when that arrived.
Mm.
And, you know, we got our first computers.
Sure.
And the internet came along and we had no idea where this was going.
Yeah.
Which we understand so much better now. But now we have all these other platforms, as we were talking about, and so-called artificial intelligence and where that's going to take us. So I'm curious about that. And I've used the AI stuff, and I think it has wonderful possibilities. But, of course, like anything, it could be used very negatively as well, as we all know. You know, I don't need to hammer on about that one. Yeah, so my curiosity, I suppose, still remains. I'm always looking for something that my curiosity in people and what they've done.
Yeah.
You know, characters and historical characters have always been a huge inspiration to me. I don't try and waste too much time on Instagram and TikTok and reels and things like that. I find...
Good idea. Massive thief of time.
And that saddens me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this generation and what's happening, there's not much time for them to sit and sort of contemplate the world and to listen to their inner being or their inner muse and their creativity. All this stuff I think is being blocked by this constant scrolling.
Well, it's really not their fault. I mean, because actually it's neuroscience and the people behind it understand dopamine fixes.
Yeah.
They are hooking them, if you like.
No, I know. It saddens me.
Yeah, I agree.
Luckily, I'm old enough to have escaped that and it's not attractive to me and it doesn't do much for me. But I have a granddaughter and so far she's 8 years old and they've kept her away from the phone and too much television and all that sort of thing. You know, a childhood that's much more like mine. It's, I don't know when it will happen, but, you know, if people do have to, I don't know if it will ever happen, but, you know, just kind of get back to basics again.
Yeah, well, I think there's going to have to be some kind of an intervention at some point because a lot of it I don't believe today is free choice because you don't actually know why you're becoming addicted to it, but certainly the platforms know very well why and are making money through that. David, I think I heard it once said of Judi Dench where they called her a national treasure, and you really are a national treasure of South Africa. It's been an unbelievable privilege to spend time talking to you today. And the impact of your work that you've created and that you are creating will, I think, continue to ripple through generations in South Africa and keep making us think and keep making us smile. So thank you for sharing your stories with us. And please continue to be that unbelievable driving force in our national identity.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I mean, it's been lovely to sit and talk to you. As you mentioned right in the beginning, we have, through the advertising agency, we've known each other since those days.
Early 90s.
But I mean, I don't get much opportunity to talk to you like this. You know, this is a really nice when one can talk properly about things. And I enjoyed your questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Look forward to seeing you again soon and to seeing your shows. Thank you so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not leave us a 5-star review? Tune in to Willing and Able next time for more conversations that challenge perspectives.
This podcast is produced by Two Stories, written by Linda Scarborough, produced by Carol Williams, with audio editing, engineering, and sound design by Kozim Zimela, with production assistance from MNC Saatchi Group South Africa's team, Maciek Dubla and Nadia Siegel. Special thanks to Sonic Nursery and Edible Audio for the recording of these episodes.